Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. This morning, we are going to welcome the U.S. Surgeon General, Jerome M. Adams, along with another special guest and former smoker. They'll be unveiling the first new national report on smoking cessation since 1990. Are you a smoker or vapor and wanting to quit? Well, we're going to talk about how you can make that happen in 2020. Then, if you're looking for a job or a career with great pay and security, we're going to connect with the Workforce Alliance to talk about state manufacturing job training programs, hiring opportunities, how employers can benefit, and where Connecticut's manufacturing industries are headed. And we'll close with IRIS, Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services, a federally recognized refugee resettlement agency, to find out how the agency is facing new challenges in its efforts to assist refugees here in the state. We're also going to invite you to the February 2nd Run for Refugees in New Haven. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Are you a high school student who likes to create videos? Maybe you could use $5,000. Well, AAA Northeast's annual 2020 Traffic Safety Video Contest is now underway with a theme that focuses on the dangers of marijuana-impaired teen driving. To compete for monetary prizes and that $5,000 grand prize, high school students in Litchfield, Fairfield, and New Haven counties should create a 30-second public service announcement video focusing on the marijuana impairment theme. April 13th is the deadline to submit, and you can access contest rules and judging criteria on the AAA website. That is AAA.com/video contest. Well, as you heard in our introduction, we're welcoming a very special and esteemed guest on the program this morning. We're calling down to Washington, D.C. to talk with the U.S. Surgeon General. Jerome M. Adams is on the line with us. Dr. Adams and Beatrice, a former smoker who was featured in the CDC's Tips from Former Smokers campaign. We'll be talking to her shortly. What's most exciting is, as we're recording this on Thursday, January 23rd, literally just a couple of hours before we're taking this call, the Surgeon General released a report called Smoking Cessation, a report of the Surgeon General. And this is the first time, if I understand correctly, Dr. Adams, since 1990, that some sort of report on this issue was addressed. So welcome to the program and thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me, John. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate you having Beatrice on, too, because we love sharing those stories of people who have successfully quit using tobacco.
Great. Well, first of all, let's talk about the ramp up to this report. It certainly seems like there was plenty of time to put it together, but also a really long runway of data gathering, I imagine, since the last report came out.
Exactly. One of the things that I want folks to understand is that there is a distinction between initiation of tobacco product use and cessation. And this is the first report in 30 years detailing the science around what we know works to help people actually quit using tobacco. And that's critically important because 34 million Americans in this country still smoke, despite the fact that we know tobacco product use is the number one preventable cause of death and disease in this country. And unfortunately, one of the things that's highlighted in the report is that there are certain subgroups, like the LGBTQ community, American Indian and Alaskan Natives, and people with mental illness diagnoses who smoke at disproportionately high rates.
Is there any information in the report that speaks to why those populations might be so much more predisposed to using tobacco?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. We know that in many cases these groups were specifically marketed to, and that's one place where we're leaning into trying to help prevent, mitigate disparities. But in this report, one of the things we highlight is that the remedies we know work, things like FDA-approved medications, like behavioral counseling, like smoke-free environments, aren't able to be equally accessed by all different populations. For folks with mental illness, we know, unfortunately, there's this belief that, hey, we've got bigger fish to fry, and that we might actually hurt their progress if we talk about quitting smoking. But the fact is, and SAMHSA has shown this, that people are actually more successful in terms of dealing with their substance misuse and mental illness diagnoses if they are in a smoke-free environment and if they're given the tools, just like the rest of us out there, to live a smoke-free life.
Well, certainly a lot of other things have happened in the world of smoking since 1990. There's been a massive amount of legal action against the tobacco industry that has yielded millions, perhaps billions, in money coming back to states for smoking awareness and education, cessation programs. How has the data gathering that is contributed to the report you released earlier today, how has the that big bubble of information and activity around the lawsuits against the tobacco industry impacted both the ability to have good or better data and the sheer volume of that data that might have been available to you to update the report?
Well, John, you bring up a great and important point. The first Surgeon General's report on smoking came out in 1964. The only other report on cessation was in 1990. And the landscape has changed dramatically from a legal, a regulatory, and a product availability point of view over that time. And we have greater transparency and a greater ability to say who's smoking, why they're smoking, what they're being marketed to. And one of the things I want to highlight is that in this report, we talk about the different interventions that have evolved over the last 30 years, three decades, to help people quit. And I think of them in three buckets. I think of individual-level interventions, like the seven FDA-approved quit medications and behavioral counseling, that unfortunately only a third of people who make a quit attempt actually utilize. I think of healthcare systems, and unfortunately about 40% of smokers who see a healthcare provider are not advised to quit. So there's things we can do there to better enable and empower and incentivize healthcare providers to have a conversation with smokers about quitting. But then, as you allude to, there are population level interventions, things like smoke-free environments, things like CDC's Tips from Former Smokers campaign, which Beatrice is featured in, things like raising the price of tobacco that we all know over 30 years of evidence shows that these are effective in helping people quit. And you hit on one of the keys, and I feel passionate about this as a former head of a state health department, that we need to more fully fund state tobacco control programs, because we know when they're fully funded, less people smoke, more people quit, and we save money, $300 billion in smoking-related expenses across this country, which comes out to about $1,000 for every man, woman, and child that it's costing our country because we haven't done enough to help people quit smoking.
We're in a very riveting conversation with U.S. Surgeon General Jerome M. Adams. Dr. Adams is joined by Beatrice, a former smoker, as he said, who was featured in the CDC's Tips from Former Smokers campaign. So Dr. Adams, certainly one of the stumbling blocks that smokers have could be one or a litany of attempts to quit in the past, and they had been
absolutely,
and they had been unsuccessful, and it just gets to the point where, whether it's one time or 20 times, the feeling of beating your head against the stone wall is just not doing anything for that wall. So let's take a few moments to actually tap into Beatrice's experience and talk to her a little bit about the fight to succeed in smoking cessation. Beatrice.
Absolutely. And you're going to love her story, John. You're going to love her story because she hits on all the points that you just laid out, the difficulty that smokers have quitting, but the fact that with the right tools, they actually can be successful.
Right. So, Beatrice, you still have a few of those Band-Aids on your forehead, I guess, from when you were beating your head against the wall trying to quit smoking. Tell me a little bit about that epiphany, that moment where you decided, no matter what happened in the past, how it didn't work, how horrible it made you feel when you weren't able to grab and light up a cigarette or whatever it was that you were consuming from a tobacco product standpoint. Tell us a little bit about that moment where you just put a stake in the ground and said, I'm going to change my life.
That moment came for me, actually, when my son wrote me a letter, and he was 11 years old. Before that, I wanted to quit, and I tried quitting several times, and I tried cold turkey, and I just was never successful. But then when I got this letter from my son, I saw that it wasn't just affecting me, it was affecting my family, and that cemented, I had to quit. It just made it really real for me, and I saw how it was affecting my family. And so that really was instrumental in helping me quit.
So how did you make it happen?
I decided this is it. I'm going to need help. I can't do it alone. So I've tried doing it alone. It didn't work out. So I went to see my doctor, and she prescribed medicine for me. And also, I also got nicotine patches. And so with a combination of the nicotine patch and the medication that my doctor put me on, it was easier to quit.
So people who may have been lifelong smokers who never tried to quit may have heard from others that, it's a nightmare, it's not worth it. Certainly you're living proof that it's worth it. But what were some of the fallback moments? Did you relapse? Did from day one you were smoke free? Tell us a little bit about the challenging moments and the way that not smoking made you feel for a while before everything started being a little bit more okay.
Sure. Well, the first few times I would quit for maybe a week, and I would say to myself, oh, I could have a cigarette. I can control this. And so I would start off smoking one cigarette, and then that would be the relapse. It didn't stop at one. I would continue. So can you just repeat the question?
Oh, sure,
again?
Sure. Yeah, yeah. What were you feeling when you were not, when you were resisting that temptation to grab the cigarette? Because certainly I've heard from a lot of people that you get these almost withdrawal feelings.
Yeah, it's difficult. It definitely is. The first 3 months, I tell anyone who's trying to quit that the first 3 months are really difficult, and you have to keep yourself out of certain situations. Like if you like to go out for drinks, maybe you shouldn't do that the first 3 months or maybe first 6 months. If you were used to having a cigarette after dinner, you should probably skip that cigarette. Try not thinking about it. But having the letter that my son wrote to me was helpful, so that every time I felt like I needed a cigarette, I would just pull out the letter, read it, and see how it was affecting him. And that was, really motivating for me.
And John, yes. Beatrice hit on a few key points here. She hit on the fact that an individual can't do it alone, that they need a supportive environment. And so we know that smoke-free environments in restaurants, in workplaces, in buildings actually help people quit smoking, because then those social cues aren't there to trigger them or to make them at higher risk for relapsing. I think that's critically important for more people to understand.
Yes, Dr. Dr. Adams, I'm also hearing from Beatrice that what a lot of people may not understand is that they can experience multiple types of cessation tools. They can utilize multiple cessation tools at the same time.
And that's a key from our report, too, that combining FDA-approved quit medications and talking to your health provider, because one of the findings from the report is that you can actually utilize different medications in concert along with behavioral therapy to help. Make no mistake about it, John, nicotine is highly, highly addictive, and we need to give people the tools that we know work to help them become successful. Some stats that are in the report, 70% of current smokers want to quit. About half make a quit attempt every year, but only about a third of those who make a quit attempt actually have utilized FDA-approved medication. So we need to get more of the tools that we know work in the hands of the people who want to quit. And if we do that, we're going to save lives and we're going to save money.
So what are, in the last couple of minutes that we have with you, Surgeon General Adams, what are a few of the important resources people can go to and rely on to actually get the job of quitting smoking done?
A great question, and I want all your listeners to know that every state has a quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. You can call in right now and talk to someone about the tools that are available in your state to help you quit. There's counseling. Most of those quit lines also have access in some way, shape, or form to FDA-approved medications and adjuncts, which will help people quit. I also encourage people to go to smokefree.gov if you're on your smartphone or on the Internet, and there are great resources there to help you develop a quit plan, to help you know the array of options that are available to help you quit and to help you be successful in this journey. And then I would encourage people to, if you have access to the Internet, go to CDC's website and look at their tips from former smokers, because I'm just a Surgeon General, John, but it's people like Beatrice out there who've been through this, who really, as peers, can speak to those cravings, can speak to those social cues, but can also speak to the evidence-based tools that they utilized to help them overcome the challenges that are in front of them as they try to quit smoking.
Well, anybody who's listening has to know that they're not alone. They've got people like Beatrice. They've got people like you, U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams. And they've got all of us here at Connoisseur Media Radio standing behind them, knowing that they can do it thanks to the tools that you're helping us become more aware of today. We want to thank U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams and Beatrice, a former smoker featured in CDC's Tips from Former Smokers campaign. Smokefree.gov is a website where you can get started to make 2020 and January of 2020 the last month that you light up a cigarette or consume tobacco products for your life. So thank you, Dr. Adams and Beatrice, for being on the program this morning, and best of luck as you are celebrating the release of Smoking Cessation, a report of the Surgeon General that was dropped today as we record this on January 23rd, the first renewed report on smoking cessation since 1990. Thank you so much for being part of the show. Well, as you heard in our introduction, and you have heard from so many guests here on the award-winning For the People, going back virtually across almost the entire 28-year span of my tenure on this program, we've been so proud to not only support Connecticut's long tradition of manufacturing, but Connecticut's manufacturers through thick and thin throughout those almost three decades here on this program. And we're continuing to do that now. Recent listeners have heard us talking so often about the great paying jobs in manufacturing in Connecticut, the job security, the clean environment, the opportunity for not just success, but advancement. And right now here in Connecticut, about 10% of our workforce is employed in manufacturing. These are mainly highly skilled, highly productive workers that are earning almost $100,000 annually, well above the state's $74,000-plus yearly per capita income. We're so pleased to be on the line right now with Bill Villano. He's president and CEO of Workforce Alliance. Bill, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good. Thank you for inviting me.
So Workforce Alliance is getting heavily involved in helping to recruit and fill the thousands of open manufacturing jobs right here in Connecticut that exist every day. We hear how unemployment is so low and that manufacturing offers such incredible opportunities and benefits. So let's talk a little bit about what the Workforce Alliance sees as far as Connecticut's manufacturing landscape goes and why you're so passionate and involved in promoting it.
Well, you said a lot of it in your introduction. I mean, you know, these are good jobs. You know, we're a big defense state. And, you know, for example, Electric Boat, if they never get another government contract, has work out to 2037. Pratt has a huge backlog of engines, work for a couple of decades, you know, and Sikorsky the same. So, you know, there's not a lot of places you can go and say you've got a job for 20 years and you've got a good paying job, you know, many with good benefits. So this is a great opportunity for people. And, you know, our low unemployment rate has presented a lot of opportunities for people, you know, but also a lot of challenges because, you know, people really need to upgrade their skills and to be able to take some of these jobs.
Well, tell us a little bit more about Workforce Alliance, your organization, and okay. the role it's playing.
So we're a job training organization. So we deal a lot with people who are entering the workforce or maybe changing, you know, deciding to change jobs or maybe only have a part-time job and want to move up. We deal a lot with people who have been laid off, you know, because of a plant closing or downsizing and need to change careers. And we also deal with young people in school or recently out of school who are obviously our future workforce. And our other customer and our main customer is the employers who, you know, who will hire these individuals.
And what's the track record of Workforce Alliance, particularly in terms of connecting your candidates to this wealth of manufacturing employment opportunity?
Right. So if I could just give you a 1 minute background. So
sure.
the program that we're running right now was developed by my counterpart in the eastern part of the state, the Workforce Board there. And they worked with manufacturers big and small. So Electric Boat, you know, which is 17,000-18,000 employers, down to the, you know, 10-person, 20-person metal fabrication shop, mm-hmm. and said, you know, what kind of skills can we give people that would provide a good, sound, basis or core for individuals that you would hire with the understanding that they would need some additional training on the job. So whether you went to work at Electric Boat or one of those smaller shops or an injection plastic injection molding shop, you know, that the balance of that training would happen there. And over the last 3 years, they've placed about 1,500 people in 200 or so different employers. So we're a little bit new into this. We've been had about 110 or so graduates so far. We've got two classes going, one at Gateway Community College and one at Middlesex Community College. And, you know, our track record, you know, is good. We've got about 60 or 70 people employed already. There's a number of people who are in job search. And there's actually a few that have decided to continue their education or coursework in manufacturing and have continued on in the community colleges taking additional coursework.
Great. Well, you mentioned defense industry work, but that is by no means where the bulk of these available jobs are. Can you give folks a little bit of an idea once again, just because so many of the people in Connecticut who aren't part of a family who's involved or working in the manufacturing
yeah.
industries, there's really very little information available for them to understand the
right.
wealth of opportunity.
Yeah, I think, yeah. So the answer to your question is, for example, Electric Boat has about 500 subcontractors that do different part work for them. And most of those are in Connecticut, some in Rhode Island, and some in the balance of the country, but probably 350 or so of those are here. And those companies not only work for the manufacturing industry, for the defense industry, but they also, you know, make other parts. So whether it's for the automotive industry or other aerospace kinds of things, there are a lot of opportunities. And I think the problem, you know, you mentioned, especially coming from a family that may have not have been involved in manufacturing, is that For years, you know, manufacturing had been shedding jobs, and you know, the opportunities didn't appear to be there. You know, that's very different now for, you know, manufacturing has shown growth year over year in Connecticut for the last 3 years, and that hadn't happened in decades. So, you know, they're back, and it's, and there's really this perception, you know, that a lot of the manufacturers are trying to counter the perception that it, you know, that these are the manufacturing jobs are the three D's, right? Dirty, dark, and dangerous, that kind of thing. And in fact, they're, as you mentioned, they're much more high tech. You know, they're, you know, some of these shops you can eat off the floor. I mean, it's more computer based, CNC based, things like that. So there are tremendous opportunities. And I think part of the problem that we wrestle with here is getting parents, superintendents, guidance counselors to realize that college is not necessarily the only option for, you know, a good career and good earnings for our young people.
Great. Well, we're going to come take a quick break. But before we do, I think it's also important to kind of broaden the focus a little bit on Workforce Alliance, because for people who may be reaching for the button getting ready to yell out to one of their listening devices to change the channel because they're not interested in manufacturing, Workforce Alliance is by no means an exclusive manufacturing pipeline
exactly.
for jobs, right?
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, really, we work with all sectors, all kinds of employers to train people either in a formal classroom training or on the job work experience. You know, we do it all. In fact, I was just in a meeting yesterday with people from Yale New Haven Hospital. Their parent, Yale New Haven Health Systems, who now own a lot of hospitals. They're the biggest employer in Connecticut now. And they've got 2,400 openings across their system. So there's a lot of opportunities now for people and in whatever particular area you're interested in, certainly not just limited to manufacturing.
Very good. Bill Villano is president and CEO of Workforce Alliance. We're going to take just a moment. Bill, stick with us on the line. Folks, stick with us on the air or on the podcast. And we'll be back right after this message to talk more about putting Connecticut back to work. And we're not talking low paying work here. We're talking great opportunity, long term security, and big paychecks. We'll be back to talk about that a little bit more. Stay with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations that would love to have your support. You can learn about a number of them through LoveCT. And if you run, work for, or volunteer for a qualified nonprofit, apply now for a chance to receive a LoveCT $5,000 radio contract to promote your event or brand. Just go to our radio station website, hit the Event Guide tab, and click onto LoveCT to apply for the grant and to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. This is John Voquette, your Public Affairs Director. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Hey, do you like to bowl? A number of our Connoisseur Media stations are proud to be longtime sponsors of the annual Bowl to Benefit, the Umbrella Center for Domestic Violence Services. It's coming up Saturday, March 7th at AMF Circle Lanes in East Haven. Umbrella is a program of BH Care that provides services for victims and children of domestic violence free of charge. Serving 19 towns in Connecticut, providing 24/7 crisis hotline, walk-in centers, safe shelters, court support, community education, counseling, and so much more. Each year, over 7,700 victims and their children walk through the door of the Umbrella Center looking for shelter, help, and hope. So lace up your bowling shoes, organize a team of friends, family, coworkers, and learn more about the 32nd Bowl to Benefit and the important work of the Umbrella Center by clicking on the events tab at bhcare.org. We're back and welcoming again Bill Villano. He's president and CEO of Workforce Alliance here in Connecticut. So, Bill, as we mentioned earlier, a lot of jobs available here, particularly in the manufacturing arena in Connecticut. It's something that we talk about a lot here on our program. So let's turn our attention to Skill Up for Manufacturing. I understand there's a course under this banner that's starting up in just a couple of days as we broadcast this on Sunday.
Right. Yes, there is. As I mentioned earlier, you know, the Skill Up Manufacturing was developed to help meet significant manufacturing employer needs in the state. And it is a demand-driven kind of program in the sense that manufacturers help design the curriculum, they help design the assessment process, and they have been active in the kind of oversight committees that, that we run to help, you know, to continuously improve the program. And it's, you know, we have good programs in the state. We have good manufacturing programs that are operated by the community colleges and the Voc Tech schools. The problem we have is that, you know, they're longer programs, they're more expensive programs, and on as a total, we're only graduating about 600 people a year into these manufacturing programs. And if you listen to the Connecticut Business and Industry Association, they say right now there's about 8 to 10,000 job openings in manufacturing in the state. So clearly at 600 a year, we're not going to meet that. And this program is a short-term program. It's 5 weeks, very intensive 5-week program, and people graduate and they are a much better entry-level employee than any manufacturer can hire off the street. 80% of the people who go through our program have not had any manufacturing experience in the past. They come from all backgrounds. But given the demand, there are plenty of opportunities for the people that we're putting through the program. And being a 5-week program, or 5 to 10 weeks, because we're going to do a plastics program, which is 10 weeks. But in a relatively short period of time, they can get the basic core skills necessary for an employer to hire and do the balance of their training on the job.
So who are eligible candidates for these jobs?
Really, there's not a lot of eligibility restrictions. I mean, we're trying to get the unemployed individuals or people who are, as the government calls, underemployed, you know, somebody who's working a part-time job, mm-hmm. or maybe two part-time jobs, and trying to get into a better skill and higher paying job. Excuse me. And they also we have all ages. I mean, we have people that are in their late teens on up to 55 plus. We have men, we have women, we've got applicants from about 40 or 45 towns around the state. There really is very few restrictions. I think you need a high school diploma or a GED as kind of a basic requirement to get into this. But beyond that, there's not much. And quite frankly, as we were talking about, we do a lot of other training and job placement. And if somebody came to us and for one reason decided not to continue with manufacturing or was looking for other options, we have plenty of options for people to explore.
So we're hearing a lot on our program, Bill, about this huge challenge that is facing particularly folks, 40 to 50 and older, who have, for whatever reason, become un or underemployed, but still have no desire or sight line to retirement. They certainly have the right attitude and work ethic. There is still a viable place in this program for folks who may really have only 5 to 10, 12 productive years right. left in their work life?
I would say yes, absolutely. And not only just in manufacturing, across the board. We just had a presentation this morning, actually, from an economist from the Department of Labor. And one of the comments he made is that the majority of the job growth recently has been in the 55 plus age group. So, you know, employers, you know, we're down to less than full employment, and the unemployment rate, you know, we're at 3.6%, I think, the last rate. So employers are having a hard time finding volume of individuals, qualified individuals. And so they're much more willing, as maybe they have not been in the past, to hire somebody who's 55 and older, who they only may get 10 years out of or 8 years out of, but you know, it will help them meet an immediate need. So I would encourage anybody, regardless of their age, you know, to be a little bit more deliberate and diligent about their job search, because employers are willing to take people that are at higher age levels.
You know, well, it's hard to believe that every Connecticut manufacturer isn't drilled right into this initiative, but I guess there are some who still need to learn more about Skill Up for Manufacturing.
Absolutely.
What do manufacturers need to know about the program?
Well, they need to know that that they can have an entry level person that will have a greater exposure, more skills, more understanding of a manufacturing operation than anyone they can hire off the street, and will put them ahead of the game. You know, we've had I've had one employer from Old Saybrook who told me that she was able, president of the company, she was able to save $100,000 a year in temporary agencies by using the Skill Up program in the East to help fill her needs. So I think you know, employers, they understand that they're getting somebody who's not a seasoned person, but somebody who's far ahead of anybody they can hire off the street.
I guess there's some opportunities as well for students who may be out or just getting out of school. They're hearing all kinds of horror stories from their peers, and they don't know where they're going to go or what they're going to do. While we talked about how working in Connecticut manufacturing can be a career and an opportunity for life, certainly it can also serve an important purpose by helping people make that transition to a life career, and in the interim, make some great money and work in a great environment.
Yeah. I mean, there are a number of people who have come to us that are exactly in that position. You know, they may have, we have a surprisingly high number of college graduates who have applied for this program. And I think it's fundamentally what you're saying. You know, they maybe have a degree in philosophy or English or something or just having a hard time finding a job in their particular field that they went into, and are seriously looking at manufacturing as an option for a very lucrative career. I mean, you mentioned early on, you know, the average wage. That wage is for somebody who's been around for a while, probably 3, 4, 5 years before they get to that level. But even entry level people can advance fairly quickly in the manufacturing world. There's a lot of options. If people continue to learn, continue to get more and more certifications, many of which employers offer and pay for, they can advance, fairly quickly, you know, up the salary scale.
Great. Well, in the last minute or so that we have with you, Bill, tell us where folks can get involved. Where can they learn about when the next classes are for this program?
Well, the easiest way probably is our website, which is workforcealliance.biz, B-I-Z. There's a portal. People can go in there and register. They'll be scheduled for an assessment, or they can actually schedule the assessment themselves. We have a number of orientation sessions that people can come to. There is information on the website. We have four American Job Centers are called in the region, New Haven, Hamden, Meriden, and Middletown, where people can also go and access information. And it's really a fairly easy and simple process to get engaged and get into this training program.
Very good. Bill Villano is president and CEO of Workforce Alliance. WorkforceAlliance.biz is the website where you start to get in on the ground level of what could be a rocket ride to your next career. Even if you're in your 50s or as young as your mid-teens, there is a place for you in the Connecticut workforce, and in particular, a lot of opportunity in the manufacturing workforce. Bill, we appreciate your time today. Thanks for joining us on the program, and I'm sure that we will continue to be talking with you and your colleagues about the importance of Connecticut manufacturing, its proud heritage, and future opportunities. Thanks so much. Well, regular listeners to our program may remember a conversation that we had last year with this gentleman who's joining us this morning on the program. Chris George is with us. He's executive director of IRIS, Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services. Founded in 1982, IRIS has been consistent in providing a new haven to refugees and other immigrants. Throughout its history, IRIS has helped refugees from all over the world. And as we're going to hear, those refugees are facing significant challenges, maybe today more than ever. Chris, welcome to the program. Exciting to have you back again, and we really appreciate you taking some time to get our listeners up to date on what's going on here in Connecticut and how your agency and the state is still playing an important role in being a place where refugees could look for some relief and safe haven. So thanks for being on the program.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me, John. And I'm really glad that you're interested in this topic, and because I think a lot of people in this state are very interested in refugees and in helping refugees and helping asylum seekers. And, you know, I'm just reminded how out of step the administration is in Washington with really the sentiment across the United States, which is generally a very welcoming we're generally a very welcoming country. We're much more welcoming in our culture and in our society and people than the government right now is. So I'm glad we're doing this show.
Yeah, certainly people are taking hard sides on the issue of refugees and immigrants right now, not just in Connecticut but across the country. What are one of the most important things that people who are or who present as staunchly against what they think your work is? What do you tell people when they just kind of throw acid in your face mm-hmm. when you say the word refugee as part of the mm-hmm. work that you do?
Well, I might start by saying, you know, Albert Einstein was a refugee, and we're pretty fortunate that that he came to the United States. There are millions of people who have come through the refugee program who are just incredible Americans. They bring talent and experience and grit and determination and a variety of perspectives from all over the world that all have combined to make this the great country that it is. Welcoming refugees is part of the American DNA. It's as American as baseball and apple pie. This is what we do as a country, and it's no surprise that a land that has attracted the best and the brightest from all over the world and refugees and welcomed them all to this country has become, you know, this great nation that, you know, we're all proud of most of the time.
Yeah, I don't think I'm out of line saying the nation is great because of what we've built together as Americans, wherever those Americans came from. So certainly, you know, a component to the defense of criticism has to include the contribution that so many immigrants and refugees have made to the workforce, especially right here in Connecticut's towns and cities.
Exactly. They strengthen the economy. They diversify our neighborhoods. Most of us believe in the value of diversity. I know that I might get an argument on that point from some people, but and there are some towns, Utica, New York, for example, that come to mind that have really been kind of resurrected by refugees who have come to the town and strengthened the economy and, you know, built new homes and populated abandoned neighborhoods. So it's really an important aspect of our immigration policy and just a really important reason why this country has become as strong and as rich as it is.
I was going to say for decades, the U.S. has been the welcoming, inclusive place for refugees to turn in their darkest hours. But today, if I understand correctly, we're in the largest refugee crisis since World War II because the U.S. is no longer a global leader in welcoming refugees.
Yes, it's a little ironic. The world is facing the worst refugee crisis since World War II. We have more refugees in the world than we have had since World War II. And at the same time, you know, as the need has never been greater, at the same time, the U.S. government is stepping away from taking the lead in resettling refugees. We should be welcoming, and we have in the past welcomed more than 100,000 refugees a year to the United States. In fact, some years we welcomed 200,000 refugees. This year, the White House has said, no, we're only going to welcome 18,000. So that's quite a drop from 100,000 to 18,000. For Connecticut, that means instead of welcoming 1,200, 1,300 refugees, and Connecticut needs refugees. I mean, we are losing population if it is not for immigrants and refugees coming to the state. Mm. So for Connecticut, it means instead of welcoming roughly 1,000 refugees a year, we're probably welcoming, you know, about 300.
And there is an element to that refugee population, as I was just reading in the Connecticut Mirror today, that are very young people who have to, in many cases, come here without any family support, completely by themselves.
Yes, there are some unaccompanied children, unaccompanied minors who come to Connecticut. Keep in mind, most of the refugees worldwide are women and children, and most of the refugees that IRIS has welcomed to Connecticut are women and children. We have used a model here in Connecticut that is not widely used across the country, but there's growing interest, and that's where we work with a community group of volunteers. Sometimes it's a church, sometimes it's a synagogue, sometimes it's a church and a synagogue and a mosque and a Rotary Club and a university, all coming together as a group of volunteers saying, hey, we would like to help resettle refugees in our neighborhood. We say, great. We train them. They prepare an apartment. They furnish it themselves. They welcome the family when it arrives. They enroll the kids in school. They'll connect them to health care. They'll help them learn English. They'll help them get a job. And before you know it, this refugee family from Afghanistan or the Congo or Iraq or some other country has gotten on its feet. The kids are succeeding in school. They're learning English. They're starting businesses, and they make great neighbors. In fact, a refugee family just moved onto my street. I live outside of Hartford, four houses down, and they're great neighbors.
Well, speaking of that, in talking both to my parents and my grandmother, who were lifetime residents of Waterbury, save for my grandmother who came over from Lithuania, there's Lithuanians living next to Albanians living down the street from Italians. There's Irish.
America, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, that's great.
Yeah, the mix was incredible. Are the refugees who are coming to Connecticut and receiving services from IRIS, are they consistently coming from the same place?
Recently, the majority of refugees that we have welcomed here to IRIS are coming from Afghanistan, and they are families of Afghans who have worked with U.S. troops in Afghanistan. They were threatened by the Taliban or other terrorist groups and had to flee. So that's the largest number that we have been welcoming. And why are they coming here? Well, because they have friends and relatives who lived here in Connecticut. And they say Connecticut is a great place. So, you know, once they have gone through this long and rigorous vetting process overseas in Kabul, Afghanistan, they're asked by the State Department, where do you want to go in the United States? Do you have a friend or relative somewhere? They say, yes, I have a relative in New Haven, or I have a relative in Hartford, and I want to go and be resettled there. So, and you know, that's how immigration has worked over hundreds of years in this country. People come to a certain town, city, they like it, they put in roots, and they invite their friends and relatives to join them.
And I don't know if it's true for the Afghans resettling in Connecticut, but I'm hearing so much about a number of these Syrian and Afghan individuals who, without whose support in country, it could have cost American lives, soldiers and security forces who depended on these now refugees to keep them safe and alive in country, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've worked overseas for almost 18 years, mostly in the Middle East, often in dangerous places, with nonprofit humanitarian groups. But I can tell you, the local staff, the drivers, the interpreters, my colleagues from the country, they risk their lives to help these projects run. And it's even more of a risk to work with military forces in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. Many of them were killed, and when they and their family members are threatened, the least we can do is to expedite their travel from these dangerous places to the United States so they can live in safety. The process takes a long time, and many of the interpreters who worked with our troops were killed while they waited, unfortunately.
Well, there are two humble and modest ways that we can help you with Connoisseur Media, Chris, and that is, first, explaining to folks how they might be able to learn about and get involved in the community co-sponsorship program.
Well, all you need to do is jump on our website. It's www.irisct.org. Iris, that's like the flower, IRISCT.org. Once you're on our website, you're going to see an array of options and opportunities to learn more, to get involved. You'll even see a promotion for our big Run for Refugees. Now, run is a little bit of a misnomer. You can also walk for refugees. It happens the morning of Super Bowl Sunday, so it's really easy to remember. This year, it's February 2nd. Now, Super Bowl, most of us are going to be doing some, relatively unhealthy things in the evening, like maybe drinking a certain beverage and eating a lot of wings. And you want to do something healthy in the morning.
Yeah, get the edge going.
Exactly. You want to get out and breathe that cool, fresh air. You want to join maybe 3,000 other people for a great celebration of this American tradition, not football, the American tradition of welcoming refugees.
Yeah, it's been around a lot longer than even the NFL, right?
Yes, and it's really a wonderful event. I just glanced at the long-term weather forecast, and I see that the weather's probably going to be partly sunny and in the 40s on Super Bowl Sunday morning in New Haven. So jump on the website, look at that, or you can go to runforrefugees.org, register, come on out. You'll have a great time. You can walk. You can turn it into a march if you like. You can run. And we have the best post-race party of any road race in the state of Connecticut.
Really a good opportunity for folks to come out and meet some of the refugees they're running for, right?
Yeah, they're going to be, what other road race will you participate in where you've got, on your left a refugee from the Congo and on your right a refugee from Afghanistan. After the race, you'll be eating food prepared by refugees from these places, delicious food. There's live music. It's just a really great event. We've been doing it for 14 years. It gets bigger and bigger every year. You definitely want to be there.
Excellent. Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services. They call themselves IRIS, A-R-I-R-I-S. IRISCT.org. IRISCT.org is their website. You can go there to learn more about what this organization's doing, learn some real truth about what you need to know about refugees here in Connecticut and the United States and the work that IRIS is doing. Get yourself registered for the Run for Refugees on Super Bowl Sunday morning here in New Haven, and perhaps maybe even get involved in getting back with the American tradition of welcoming others from somewhere else who need you. Chris George is Executive Director for IRIS. Chris, thank you so much for your time this morning and this important information. We'll see you at the race. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.